Good evening. My name is... Oh, my goodness, this is loud. Good evening. My name is still Paul Holdengrabe. I'm the Director of Public Programs here at the New York Public Library, now thankfully known as Live from the New York Public Library. And I'm delighted to welcome you to the second event in our fall season. We just had the pleasure of having Oliver Sacks 3 days ago. Tomorrow, if you would like to come back, you will be able to hear the actress Mary Louise Parker and the singer-songwriter Ryan Adams discuss their shared passion for poetry. Week after next, join Peter Gelb, the director of the Metropolitan Opera, and the theater directors Patrice Chéreau and Bart Scheer in a conversation I will instigate entitled Cognitive Theater, the very thing we try to do here at Live from the New York Public Library. Much else awaits you, so take a look at the program, join the email list, look at us on YouTube, download us, but most importantly, converse with each other. Nothing outlives, I believe, the human contact. As I often say, you can't tickle yourself. As tonight's conversation will demonstrate, the search for home, I would say, rather than a homepage. Consider performing an act of civic duty. Become a member of the New York Public Library, just $40 a year. It's rather a cheap date, and you will get discounts to all kinds of events, live events, and much, much else. What happens in the aftermath of disaster, Rebecca Solnit wonders, and she offers somewhat startling answers, as well as wonderful stories. I like these lines from her chapter entitled Dorothy Day's Other Loves, from her new book, A Paradise Built in Hell, The Extraordinary Communities That Arise in Disaster. Here she writes that Oscar Wilde, it's always wonderful to quote Oscar Wilde because he happens to always have been right, Oscar Wilde asked for maps of the world with utopia on them, where she inquires are the maps of the human psyche with altruism, idealism, and even ideas on them, the utopian part of the psyche, or just the soul at its most expansive. It is, I believe, the soul at its most expansive that inspires Rebecca Solnit. I think hope haunts her. She has written wonderfully about the subject in her book, Hope in the Dark, Untold Histories and Possibilities, and Wild Possibilities. In reading her, I think of Vaclav Havel in prison, where he wrote that hope is definitely not the same thing as optimism. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense regardless of how it turns out. Whenever I think about hope, I'm always reminded of Kafka's great line that there is hope, but not for us. Yet optimism, like kindness, gets bad press among those who think deeply. Solnit, like Adam Phillips and Jan Morris, gives acts of kindness and optimism a better name. Reading Rebecca always reminds me of my father, who at the age of 91 years is one of the only intelligent optimists I know. I also love Rebecca's book on walking, on the history of walking, entitled Wanderlust. I really suggest you read it. Tonight, to instigate the conversation, we have the pleasure of welcoming the wonderful actor and activist Peter Coyote. When I asked Peter how best to introduce him briefly, he wrote, "Peter Coyote came from nowhere and is working his way back." If you want to know a bit more about him, you should also know that he is an actor in more than 120 films, a prize-winning author whose book Sleeping Where I Fall has just been reprinted. He and Rebecca will both sign their books right after this conversation. As always, I want to thank our independent, and I stress independent, bookseller, 192 Books, for being here and being always so helpful. Peter will say more about Rebecca, and Rebecca may also say what connects her to Peter, an ex-digger. Ladies and gentlemen, please warmly welcome Rebecca Solnit and Peter Coyote.
Thank you, Paul, and thank you, everyone, for coming. When I was a young man, it always seemed to be effortless to be connected to my historical moment, and I seemed to know everything that was going on effortlessly. And as I've gotten older, maybe my growing regard for the moment itself has made me a little myopic. So I often find myself discovering things breathlessly and running to tell people, like saying to my son, "You've got to hear this guy, Bruce Springsteen," and getting one of these earth to dad looks. And I actually felt that way. It seems impossible that Rebecca and I have not met. We both live in San Francisco. We're both Zen students in the same community. We inhabit the same political and moral landscape. We know so many people in common. And yet when I started to research, and she writes regularly for Harper's and The Nation and Tom's Dispatch, which I read regularly. And she has written 12 books, and when I began reading her, I was flabbergasted, and I thought, oh my God, I've got to share the discovery of this person. And then I thought, as I was coming into the library, no dummy, they know, they're New Yorkers. It's you that's catching up. But for the several of you that don't know, I'm thrilled to have discovered this writer, an upright, good-humored, moral presence of kind of vast dimension. And I'm thrilled to welcome you to the New York Public Library and honored to be talking to you this evening.
Thank you, Peter.
You're more than welcome. So for those that have not yet read this book, let me just give a brief précis before we dive in. Rebecca has documented the fact, it's not a theory, she's documented the fact that in most disasters, the walls between people are broken down, and people en masse, rather than being brutish and short and nasty, are actually generous and inventive and practical. And it's often the elites who panic and behave badly to try to reshore up their order and the injustice that preceded the collapse. And I'm just curious as to what in your background gave you the intuition to search in that direction.
Well, it was an intuition I share with several million other people in the Bay Area. After the Loma Prieta earthquake, and I know this, they laugh, October 17th, 1989, I was fascinated by my own response, which was to immediately forget about being angry at somebody I'd been angry about and that whole drama, to care deeply about the people who are in my immediate vicinity emotionally, to be drawn into this very rich and intensified here and now, and drop all the other stuff that we clutter our lives with, the kind of trivia fell away. And then I started to go visit the people I cared about and found this weird sense of joy. And for years afterwards, even now when I ask people about the 89 earthquake, often their faces light up. And that was an intuition that came, or not an intuition, that was a discovery, that came back to me after 9/11, because in a weird way, a lot of people seem to be having not a good time, we don't even have the right emotional language for it, but a rich, deep, purposeful, connected time that a lot of us have a very hard time finding in everyday life, the meaningful work, the sense of community, the sense of connection, the non-attachment to possessions and statuses and squabbles and things like that. And it just kept coming up again and again, and I thought, I need to get to the bottom of this joy. And so it really began with joy.
And then you research these successive disasters. I was struck when I was reading about it, about the way in which war has the same dual fascination. There's a horror, but also men and women who've lived through it describe it as a peak experience and often refer to the camaraderie and solidarity.
I think that we need to sort of distinguish between prosecuting war, which means killing people, and that rage and that conviction that these people are not human and it's okay to kill them, or whatever goes through the mind of somebody who sets out to kill, versus people who are just surviving war, who often experience it very much less any other disaster. And the difference between an earthquake and a bomb is not always so significant when you're pulling somebody out of the rubble, for example, or improvising a community kitchen afterwards.
Well, one of the things that you talked about is kind of a threnody that went through the book. This was a little quote I pulled out of it. But you talked about the central question of, do we care for each other or don't we? And I was thinking that really that's the underlying question of the healthcare debate right now.
Yeah.
And so let me just read this quote and get a comment from you.
Okay.
It's you speaking and saying, economic privatization is impossible without the privatization of desire and imagination that tells us we're not our brother's keeper.
You know, I think the American system, almost uniquely in the developed world, and maybe in the world, is devoted to the idea of the individual as freestanding, solitary, separate, independent. And independent is such a strong word in this country, starting with the Declaration of Independence, that often means that is taken to mean the opposite of interdependent. And it's funny because often, you know, we both live in the American West, where a lot of people assert that they're independent, and people like ranchers and farmers who, of course, rely on massive government subsidies and government land, government water in lots of ways. But I think it's also, there's an emotional withdrawal where you don't recognize that we live in a system together, that it's cooperation that makes it possible to even walk or drive down the street, that every day enormous cooperation is going on, that even though we think capitalism itself is based on competition, you know, it's the cooperation within those firms as well as the competition between them that defines it. So I think we've really been taught to not see the cooperation we depend on and to not value it. And we've been taught that we're independent in the sense of being isolated and not connected to each other, which is really kind of lonely, which is why disaster often mitigates that sense of isolation and alienation, which is one of the first joys that often happens, people are in it together.
I've been struck over and over. I spend a lot of time in Europe, and I live in Europe, and I'm happy to be there. And I look back at my own country, this rich, fabulous, vital, inherently generous country, which has been infected with a kind of virus of selfishness. I mean, if you listen to the healthcare debate and you listen to the debate on taxes, everybody seems fixated and focused on what's theirs. And yet you go to these older cultures where ostensibly there's less to go around, and the people have made a decision over and over and over again to care for each other. So when you look at people on the street, you're being passed by people that have said, yes, I voted to take care of you. And it creates a very different sensation than you get outside on Fifth Avenue. And I've never been able to fully account for that. How did we go from this optimistic generosity? How did this get corralled, suppressed, and diverted into a kind of official hard-heartedness?
Don't you think that we have both in this country, though? We both have this sort of frontier do-it-yourself spirit, which can be quite wonderful, and which is very much like disaster, where you start out with nothing and build a house and build a farm and build everything from scratch, which is very independent, and also this sort of ability to do things that can be very generous and altruistic. But I think, you know, the healthcare debate in particular seems so manipulated, and 47% of Americans are already on some kind of government healthcare. They're on the veterans benefits, they're on Medicare, they're on Medi-Cal or something like that, and that doesn't come up. And the fact that the people who are uninsured are essentially being paid for us anyway when they show up in emergency rooms and et cetera doesn't show up. And you can see that the moneyed interests, who are a very small minority in this country, and the media who go along with them so obediently, have given us a completely fictitious debate involving things like
death panels.
Death panels that don't exist, but also statistics and facts and realities that don't exist. Either the reality that we're already interdependent and that almost half of us are already on government care, it could just be a little bit better organized, you know, or the reality that this is what it would look like if we change it, and maybe the reality that every other sort of developed nation in the world has pretty much has something like this. And so, you know, the debate is based on a lot of fictions funded by a lot of wealthy senators and what somebody recently called our House of Lords. People like Max Baucus, who are getting truly insane amounts of money from
$2 million something from healthcare
providers. Yeah. So, you know, they're not reality. There are these weird people who have way too much power, but they're not everyday life. And one of the things that struck me most powerfully working on this book is that we often speak as though we need to get these things into everyday life that do not yet exist. And I think many of them don't exist enough, but this book really convinced me of how much altruism, how much generosity, how much gift economy, how much collaborative and cooperative stuff goes on between parents and children and lovers and friends and co-workers and strangers on the street and people involved in activist organizations, etc. And if you ask anybody what kind of a society we live in, they would say we live in a capitalist society, and they often say it, in, at least in my part of the and your part of the world, with great rue. But in fact, capitalism doesn't really work very well, and it's propped up by an enormous amount of communal and generous mm-hmm. and selfless and altruistic effort. And that's not just a liberal and radical thing. It's also the work that a lot of church groups are doing. My lovely aunt is here, and we're just talking about the work the Catholic Church does in supporting undocumented immigrants in the crises that they face. And there's just a lot of, you know, our society is already made up of a lot of anti-capitalist, anti-competitive things, but it's not the story we're told about ourselves. Just as who we are in disasters is generous and altruistic, but that's not the story we're told about ourselves. These stories don't fit into the official story, and they kind of fall by the wayside, which is why I tried to pick them up.
Well, you call me to task correctly, because it is true that both exist, and I was thinking as you were answering, gee, why did I look at heads and not tails of that particular equation, because we both live in that kind of cooperative, hopeful community. And I guess that I'm feeling somewhat discouraged by the pressure of the overlay of the yeah. media world and the way things are being reported. It leads me to another quote about your book where this argument devolves around varying ideas of human nature. So the quote is, "The argument against such keeping of one another is often framed as an argument about human nature. We're essentially selfish, and because you will not care for me, I cannot care for you. I will not feed you because I must hoard against starvation, since I too cannot count on others." And, you know, it's crazy, but there's a perverse logic to it. If you see the world that way, then the kind of official selfishness that I've been concentrating on actually makes sense. And yet to those of us who see the other side, the cooperative, the generous, yeah. it appears like a kind of social affliction, doesn't it?
It does. I have to call it the capitalism of the heart, when scarcity economics become how people conduct their emotional and interior lives. And, you know, but it's funny because a lot of people believe this stuff, but it's still not what governs them. And a lot of people don't believe in this interdependence, don't believe in these things. But in a disaster, they still pull you out of the rubble and feed you from their community kitchen. And there's actually a wonderful sociologist, Michael Schwartz, pointed out to me that it's actually not just that some people have pernicious beliefs that undermine them that's interesting, but that a lot of people have pernicious beliefs that don't really affect, particularly in a crisis where a lot of that stuff falls away, and they behave, you know, remarkably anyway. And then often, I think because they don't have that language for it, they go back to the, you know, the world we have the language for, that social Darwinist world that believes in competition and survival of the fittest, etc., rather than in mutual aid and cooperation as the terms of our survival.
Well, you tell a story in the book that really shocked me, because I never saw it as clearly as you presented it before. I grew up in the era of bomb shelters.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I read your book that I understood that bomb shelters failed in the United States, basically because the majority of citizens could not comprehend defending their bomb shelters against their neighbors. And it just kind of evaporated and went away. And when I read that in your book, I went, oh my God, yes, that's true.
I found that so fascinating. It was something I learned doing the research for this, that, you know, that in the Soviet Union, you know, most solutions for surviving nuclear war were collective. You had these big collective shelters. America privatized survival. You were supposed to build your own shelter in your suburban backyard. And there was this enormous debate as the Cold War got hotter and hotter about, would you barricade yourself in there and turn away the neighbors and let them die of starvation and radiation sickness, or would you let them in? And the moral dilemma was so repulsive. The idea of becoming these surviving, you know, in this kind of brutal, selfish way, was so repulsive to people that they just didn't want to have anything to do with it, most of them. And it's funny because, as with most disasters, the scenario was that we would become rapacious, Hobbesian creatures murdering each other to survive. And there were people who asserted that they were going to defend their bomb shelters with their submachine guns or whatever. But most people just thought it was repulsive and would have nothing to do with it. And that part of civil defense failed.
You know, I was too young. I was 10 or 11 years old when we were being taught to hide under desks and, you know, from nuclear attacks. And so reading it was just such a shock to me because I remember the Life magazines and the stockpiles of canned tuna and stuff that you'd rather die than eat for 11 years underground. And you capped it. So I want to take a little bit of a turn because a word popped out. When you described the 89 quake in California, the Loma Prieta quake, you used the word enjoyment. And you related it to this sense of immersion and involvement that people had, which was caused by the rupture of everyday life. And it led me to speculate on the 60s. On the extended rupture of everyday life, which was kind of a decade-long experience with the counterculture.
And a rupture that was intentionally made, which I think is really interesting, you know, in these relationships. I was very excited when I found out you were going to be the other half of the conversation here because you were part of the Diggers, which we should explain to. How many of you know what the Diggers were? Wow, that's not bad.
Literate group.
And, you know, and because so many things there are so relevant to this book, and I was so fascinated with Katrina, how many counterculture groups, you know, the descendants of the Panthers, the Rainbow Family, and in a limited way, Burning Man, all became part of the disaster relief effort. And the way that almost so many of these countercultural festivals were really festivals of survival and, of improvisation outside the system that prepared people really well for a catastrophe.
It's really funny. In California, we're urged to have earthquake kits all the time. And I spent years and years living in my truck and traveling around. So in the trunk of my little biodiesel Volkswagen today is basically half the kit from my old hippie truck. I have my kitchen box, and I've got sleeping bags, and I've got a little tent for my wife. It's all old, and I've had it for years and years. But when I look at the body of skills that all of us developed in the counterculture, I think at some point you or someone you quote in your book said they loved learning mechanical tasks. I learned to weld. I learned to do plumbing. I learned to do, like poor people learn to do everything as well as they do anything. And I think that counterculture experience has kind of permeated the majority culture in a lot of ways, and I wonder what you think about that.
Well, the punk version, which is my generation, was DIY, do-it-yourself, DIY.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And, and it was also really important. And there's this new kind of craft do-it-yourself generation that's also very interested in raising chickens and tomatoes in the city and kind of getting back, you know, figure out where your food comes from and composting and just trying to be part of systems that are small enough that you have some agency and that they make sense. And I think it's that the dominant culture has made us more and more and more removed from all these systems of survival. But there's always been a subterranean current in this culture since people started getting yanked off the farms and things to kind of reconnect in a lot of ways. And I think it's a very deep impulse both towards pleasure and towards safety and survival that you see. But you should tell people about what the diggers were, or I'll start telling them and I'll get everything wrong.
I'll be interested to learn.
I had a long digression about the Diggers in an early version of the book that didn't quite fit in, and I was also very stoked. I live in the neighborhood he was in the 60s, and although I call my part the Panhandle, not the Haight-Ashbury. But the original Diggers, who are part of the English revolutionary climate, the chaos after the English Civil War.
After the enclosure movement, when the king took the commons to raise his sheep for his new woolen mills. They took the common grazing lands, and the people, under a sort of organized by a pamphleteer named Gerard Winstanley, was the first guy to get out and really write against private property, like Proudhon, property is theft. And they were called the Diggers because the king sent Cromwell against them, and every morning they were seen burying their dead.
But also they're called the true levelers because they wanted to level society and to make it more horizontal. And they're also coming out of the chaos of the religious and civil wars of England. And what one of the things that I hadn't understood until I did this book is that Hobbes, who wrote that life is nasty, brutish, and short, and that man in his original state is engaged in a war of each against each, was an exact contemporary of the diggers. And there's such a tendency to believe, first, that we revert to a Hobbesian nature in crisis, and secondly, that Hobbes was, kind of what life, his worldview was kind of what life is like in those chaotic circumstances of England in the mid-17th century. And to see that the diggers were exact contemporaries responding to the same thing by saying, let's collectivize, let's share, let's be communards, let's dismantle and form a better system, that this really utopian and generous impulse came out of the same situation, really undermined the notion that Hobbes is an inevitable reaction to
crisis. Yeah, he just gets the good press.
Not anymore. If I can, but the diggers you were part of were all also about giving things away for free, about subverting the social structures, and about opening things up in a lot of ways.
Being free and being anonymous. We were responding to a crisis in San Francisco, which was that the national media was advertising this Haight-Ashbury experience, and kids from all over the country were flooding the city, and the city was chartering bus tours to come and look at us like we were species in a zoo, and nobody was caring for these kids that were on the street. And we decided to put the lie to the kind of official bullshit, and we just said, let's just start feeding people. And we gradually wound up feeding about 600 people a day. We got medical students to come in and run free medical clinics. We had free stores where you could get everything from a television to clothing to shoes. And we used them all as kind of pieces of theater to publicly investigate what's a consumer, what's an owner, what's a commodity. Why should you work for someone to earn a salary so that you can become a consumer? That didn't seem like much for a young man. So it was about a 5 or 6 year long kind of art experiment. And then we evolved into a larger intentional community called the Free Family and set up a string of communes around the Northwest and the Southwest and pursued a kind of countercultural alternative for a long time, which had its own problems and dilemmas, but the skills that we learned from it and the skills that a whole generation learned, all those kids from Harvard and great schools meeting poor working class kids and learning skills, that body of lore is still alive in the culture, surfacing in Katrina and surfacing in 9/11, the kind of can-do spirit. And while I think that we lost all our political battles, we didn't end capitalism or imperialism or stop the war, I do think that we won all the cultural battles, and there's no place in the United States today where you can't find an alternative food movement, a women's movement, environmental movement, alternative medical practices, alternative spiritual practices. And I guess I believe still, as I did then, that culture is a deeper and more obdurate force than politics.
Politics are the weeds that grow from the dirt of culture.
That's a great quote. So here's a question that I had for you.
So those were the diggers. Important background.
Just so you know where I'm coming from.
Wonderful things happened. Like a lot of soldiers were going AWOL from the Vietnam War, and they could come into the diggers' free store and essentially change out of their military uniform into civilian clothes, pick up a new identity, and walk out free men, which I thought was really quite wonderful.
And went to an even farther extreme, which I have to share with the sophisticated New York audience. There was a drag queen commune called the Cockettes in San Francisco. Real burly linebackers with hairy chests and hairy legs who favored tutus and kind of penis popsicles that they'd walk around the streets. But their war resistance was to pull a van up to the Oakland Army Bureau and take young inductees and offer them oral sex and photograph it with a Polaroid camera and then give them the print so they could go in and prove to the draft officer that they were homosexual and unfit to serve. It just gives you an idea of the climate where we live.
So you're saying more than food was given away.
My more heavens. Than food was given away, yeah. There were people I knew that actually used to date at the VD clinics. what are you doing next Thursday? So let me ask you this question before we get... This is a quote from your book. The positive emotions that arise in those unpromising circumstances demonstrate that social ties and meaningful work are deeply desired, readily improvised, and intensely rewarding. The very structure of our economy and society prevents those goals from being achieved.
The thrust of my book is that everyday life is a disaster, that sometimes even disaster can liberate us from, that most people don't have that meaningful work, they don't feel connected enough to the people around them, that, you know, and we're, you know, a system that's built on consumption wants us to be consumers, not citizens. And I think being a citizen is really the antithesis of being a consumer. You become a producer of meaning. You have all these pleasures that money can't buy. You might be a lot less interested in buying things. You may, with the collective power of civil society, make some radical changes and in your society, which is part of why the aftermath of disaster in any moment when people congregate as civil society is quite intimidating or even terrifying to the business elites and et cetera. And we also don't have the language for it. And that's what struck me over and over again is that we have so
language
much...
Language for what?
Public pleasure, social pleasure, you know, this sort of love that's of society, of membership in society, et cetera. We hear so much about erotic love and family life, which are so fetishized and celebrated right now. And they're great and they're lovely, but there's, you know, it's part of the private world. There's a whole public world where you're also a citizen, where you also are somebody participating in making history and making a nation and making a community and making meaning that doesn't necessarily take place in the private realm. And everybody, in some sense, is part of that project, but they don't feel it, they don't feel they have a voice. And every time you see them get it, as I did, for example, on February 15th, when people on all seven continents rose up against the current war, you see this incredible joy of feeling like you belong to something big and powerful and meaningful, that you're able to participate in creating meaning, that you're a writer of history, not just a reader of it, that you're a maker of history, not a victim of it. And, you know, which sounds very grandiose, but I think it's also about having agency in everyday life, about what you eat and what, you know, what your work is like and how things are connected and how decisions are made, etc. So I think we don't have enough language in this culture. You see more in Latin America where people are able to seize these disaster moments, talk about civil society and build more on them. And, you know, and that the language is one thing we need to... When you have an experience that there's no language for, you may have an extraordinarily wonderful experience, but it slips through your grasp. And to be able to understand it, build on it, make it more likely, make it the basis for a life, you need to be able to understand it and name it and discuss it, you know, converse about it, etc. And we have so little language for that. It's not part of who we are in American politics, certainly. And one of the things that strikes me every election cycle is that they constantly talk about families, and families is really a private unit where citizens are a public unit, you know, and you may be a member of a family, but that's not all you are. And they don't really talk about us as citizens. Families have needs, citizens have rights. And, you know, so I feel like a shift in the language would shift us towards understanding our own nature as public beings, by which I mean, you know, and of course New York is a funny place to talk about it because it's a place with the best public life in the United States where people are pretty bold and fearless and engaged, you know, all the time. I often wonder what would have happened if 9/11 had happened in LA. Would people even understand that you could evacuate a million people on foot, that, you know, that you can trust the people next to you? And I feel like the everyday coexistence of people on the streets of New York, you know, it's such a powerful thing that equips people to cope with these extreme moments, and that citizenship is survival equipment, and that people here have it in a very intense way because they live in public. They walk and they take public transit, and stockbrokers and janitors are on the same subway trains and on the same streets in a way that someplace like LA is very segregated. You know, you have your garage door openers and passes, and you can actually spend, you know, there are probably people who spend weeks without actually being out of doors.
God, you send my mind in so many directions. I want to ask you.
Sorry about that.
No, it's It's my mind normally is like five gerbils in a weasel cage, and so just trying to keep track of them. I wanted to ask you about this idea of, you said something about like walking down the street with 100,000 other people, it feels the same way as a great experience. And one of the things that struck me, because I came of agency in the 60s.
Yeah.
And during the 60s, we were resisting the Vietnam War, and the dynamic of it was quite different. We were physically going out in the street, and we were physically being spoken to and educated by professors or people who knew. And when you were there, somebody would give you a piece of paper and say, we're all going there. And in the last several months of the Bush administration, the George II administration, I was comparing the end of his regime with the end of Lyndon Johnson.
Yeah.
And in the last 3 months of Lyndon Johnson's regime, he was rendered powerless. He could not govern because citizens were out in the street en masse and they made the country ungovernable. And in the last 3 months of the Bush administration, he was still causing mischief, unwinding, making directives, appointing, you know, rotten people into civil service positions where they'd continue to serve forever. And I began to get suspicious that even my own affinity for writing and blogging might have been a great contributor to this, that a virtual community does not bring you sick when soup when you're sick, it doesn't bury you when you're dead, and that all of us now are, we're free to speak, but we're speaking at our computers, and we're not in the streets. And I'm wondering kind of why that is and what you think about that.
You know, people were in the streets in mass when it seemed like it had effect in 2003 and at other moments. In my, you know, frankly, I think that the activism of the 1980s was much more broad-based and grassroots a lot of times. I mean, you had a million people in Central Park against nuclear weapons. The biggest civil disobedience arrest in U.S. history, I believe, was at the Nevada test site in the late 80s and things like that. There are these other moments of deep engagement, I think, that also matter, and other ways people do engage. And it's funny because the person sitting closest to me in the audience is Nick Terse, who I know through Tom Dispatch. He works with, so they're here. And a lot of, I think the internet is part of how we organize or the shutdown of the Seattle of the WTO in Seattle in 1999. And I think that it's a tool. People have withdrawn, you know, that people have been encouraged to withdraw, and you probably lived through the dot-com boom somewhat the way I did in San Francisco, where you had all these people who moved to San Francisco because they actually wanted to live in a public space, and San Francisco's not quite New York, but it's got much more public street pedestrian life than the rest of the country in between. But the rhetoric was constantly about how the internet was so great because you never had to meet a stranger, you never had to stand in line, you never had to go out in public space, and it was always portrayed as dangerous and inconvenient, rather than as like some kind of pleasure where you might meet your future wife or have a fabulous conversation or discover something you didn't know. So I think trying to take randomness and free movement out of the system is something that the internet's often tried to do. It's like the difference between using an internet card catalog and browsing the stacks. But that it still happens, and you see this counter impulse. So in the activism, it's hard to say. And I was busy playing with plastic horsies in the 60s. And so I was actually at some of the things you're at, like the human being, but I was like this tall. So, you know, and it's like this legacy that hangs over my generation and we rebel against, so we probably shouldn't even go there or I'll get all fractious and resentful.
I'm describing an ambivalence.
But I think that there are these moments, you mean then or now?
No, I'm describing an ambivalence about computers, that everything has a shadow side that we don't always look at.
I think it goes both ways, because on the other hand, the amount, the information, you know, things have been very democratized in terms of information access, whether you want VD information or information on weapon, you know, lies and the Bush administration. People have access to things, and I was telling a friend in a small town in southern Utah, you know, I was complaining about Amazon and at one point, and he said, well, you know, for a San Franciscan, Amazon is a step down from your fabulous bookstores. For people who have no bookstores, Amazon is a step up. Mm-hmm. And the fact that anyone with access to the internet can order almost any book that isn't just in print, but that used to be in print, and that, you know, and we won't even get into Google Books, which is a whole complicated thing. But I think there's a lot of power there, and that people do communicate freely with each other and find information freely that used to be much harder to get. And I spent a lot of time doing research that people wouldn't do, and I'm good at going to libraries and into archives and finding out things that is a lot easier now. And I think that there's a lot of power in that. And that, you know, there was Michael Massling did a fabulous piece in the last New York Review, a couple New York Review of books ago, about the way that a lot of the major stories of the last several years have broken on the internet first, and in these places where they wouldn't really, you know.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah, and then the internet is one of the major forms of alternative media now, where stories go that aren't, we'll get in the New York Times and in CNN when they get hallowed. I'm actually looking at another friend of mine, A.C. Thompson, who did incredible work in the audience, did incredible work on the vigilantes in Katrina, which began with The Nation magazine. It was a story most people in the media, you know, was out in plain sight in certain ways, but people didn't want to know it.
Do you know what she's talking about when she talks about the vigilantes in Katrina?
You know,
because
it's,
you should tell that story.
You know, I think the major untold story of Katrina, which I try and tell, is about the massive volunteer effort on the part of people who were in the affected communities, on the part of people all around the country. These incredible efforts from the Cajun Navy, as they're called, who were driving bumper to bumper into the city the next day with their boat trailers to rescue people, to the people who volunteered housing all around the country, to the people who've gone down to rebuild, ranging from Mennonites to anarchists and everything in between. But you know, one of the other things I talk about in the book is why some people, although they're a small group, behave terribly in disasters because of their beliefs that since we're all reverting to a Hobbesian state of nature, I need to defend myself against you. And these are the people who will arm themselves and essentially panic. Although with the vigilantes on the other side of the river from the city of New Orleans, it's hard to tell to what extent they're having an opportunistic race war and to what extent they were genuinely convinced that they were protecting their community. But they shot many black men. They, most so far as we can tell, killed some.
And bragged about it on film to a Danish film crew.
Yeah, and you know, and it was this weirdly visible story, if you wanted to look, that the mainstream media would not look at.
Well, which leads me to your relevant quote. You said there are two other important factors to remember. I'm just reminding you of what you actually said.
Still, you did your homework.
Two other important factors to remember. One is the behavior of the minority in power.
Yeah.
And you gave us this wonderful term, elite panic, who often act savagely in a disaster, and the other is the beliefs and representations of the media, the people who hold up a distorting mirror to us in which it's almost impossible to recognize these paradises and our possibilities.
You know, the media in Katrina was fascinating because it literally fell apart, and it fell into two camps. A lot of the people on the ground, including right-wing people from Fox News and stuff, became passionate they gave up silly ideas about objectivity and became passionate advocates for the people who were stuck in the city, which was essentially a prison city at that point. People were not allowed out, supplies were not allowed in. And so you had these people who were very passionate, who were emotional, who were clearly committed to these people. They weren't pretending to be neutral.
Even Fox News.
Yeah, which was amazing but not surprising, perhaps. And then you had the further away people who were willing to believe any crazy rumor about marauding hordes and savagery and baby rapists and killers, and who are obsessed with this word I think we need to banish from the English language, looting, which is basically theft, you know, written in neon letters that seems to cause hysteria. And so much so that the governor and mayor of Louisiana and New Orleans decided that protecting private property was more important than rescuing human beings.
And worth the death penalty.
Yeah, and that also, as with the 1906 earthquake, decided that the death penalty for property crimes was without a trial was appropriate. That's what elite panic is when people are so convinced that order needs to be reimposed at the point of a gun. They're so afraid of what people do. And they're so convinced, you know, and I sometimes think this is their own image writ large, that the rest of us are barbarians who need to be subjugated, that they lose empathy and connection, et cetera. And because they wield disproportionate power, they can make a natural disaster into a social catastrophe, and they have.
So, but why do you think, I mean, if you take a closed loop,
yeah.
the media relayed these stories of events which did not happen in the Superdome. There weren't rapes and babies were not killed and people were not murdered. It just didn't happen. And yet they were broadcast far and wide. And one wonders, is this to solidify a worldview which will justify the state in its power? Is this to sell newspapers? I mean, these people know better. They're sophisticated people.
But they don't. They believed it. And it was interesting seeing people like Timothy Garton Ash, who's a senior columnist for The Guardian in the UK, get pretty hysterical himself, believe all the rumors, and write that this proves that Hobbes... He actually wrote that this proves that Hobbes is right, and he trotted out all the Victorian cliches about the thin veneer of... scratch the thin veneer of civilization, and you see the ravening beast underneath, and stuff like that, except that he had...
From a guy with a hyphenated last name.
Yeah. But... you know, I think that the elites actually believe this, but it's part of believing that they're necessary. They're necessary because we're barbarians who must be subdued, and the media believes this. It's a set of myths that have been recycled over and over from disaster to disaster. It's a set of myths that Hollywood likes. I'd actually be curious to see what you think about this, since you've spent a little more time there than I have. My impression is that the structure of a disaster movie is that you need a lot of chaotic, helpless, largely idiotic, and sometimes barbaric, ordinary people to sort of set off the hero in all his magnificence, that ordinary people have to be a background of crumminess against which a ubermensch man in the foreground shines. And in fact, in disasters, most of us...
It's all done by one guy.
Yeah, yeah, and it's usually Charlton Heston.
Yeah, and there's always, if there's a John Wayne, there's always a Jimmy Stewart who represents a kind of nutless goodness. And, you know, John Wayne, who can't keep civilization going in the long haul, but he can come in and kick the crap out of the bad guys. And then, of course, he has to leave the world to the Jimmy Stewarts. But it's the way in which common decency is represented as without power and agency that's a staple of Hollywood movies.
I hadn't thought about that aspect, too, but I didn't talk to you when I was writing the book, but probably the most unpleasant, you know, I hung out in the Lower Ninth in New Orleans not long after Katrina, and I talked to a lot of people about really terrible things they'd endured. This is not a celebration of disaster, but of the spirit that rises to meet it and some of the social possibilities it reveals. But probably the most unpleasant thing I did is watch a lot of classic disaster movies for this book. And they really were so repetitive and... just so demeaning, really, these people. I literally, this is where we get our images of stampeding, panicking people. And the disaster scholars, whose work is so little known, I hope will become a little better known, really set out after World War II to figure out, and this is part of the Cold War, how would we behave in the aftermath of an all-out nuclear war? And the assumption was that you had to plan for people being pathetic idiots and losers and monsters, etc. And they started to look at how people actually behave in all the disasters that they were able to study and began to realize that panic and, to a large extent, looting, etc., were all myths, and that the whole stereotype of us as sort of Hobbesian man had very little to do with reality and disaster, and that, in fact, you saw what I call Kropotkinian man, something based much more on mutual aid, on altruism, on generosity, on enormously impressive resourcefulness and inventiveness in disaster. And, and if that's who we really are, then you can start from that premise to reimagine everything. And it's one of the most fun... And it's essentially, disaster becomes a case... in which the questions about human nature become urgent. Who are we really? You know, if we're really monsters, then we need authoritarianism and guns and subjugation and, et cetera, which is what we got in Katrina, what we got in 1906. If, in fact, we're actually pretty resourceful and do really well ourselves, then the government needs to aid citizens and the citizens might need to aid. What government is at its best in disasters? And, this is a book that has some wonderful cops and amazing firemen and things. This is not a totally anti-government book. And in 89, for example, the city of San Francisco realized that it didn't, even in a small, a relatively minor earthquake, a medium-sized earthquake with an epicenter 60 miles south, it did not have the resources to respond. There were not enough firemen in the city to, and actually hundreds of volunteers, including friends of mine, helped put out the marina fires. And didn't Stuart Brand get all excited about it too?
Yeah.
But now we're talking about San Franciscans. Never mind people. Never mind New Yorkers. And so the city of San Francisco's response was to develop the neighborhood emergency response teams, NERT, which said that, you know, you essentially will be the first responders, you will be the resources, and all we're doing is delegating, equipping, giving you permission and a little bit of training to work, particularly with firefighters who are the people who really count.
And also you pointed out that in New York during 9/11, the people were not treated as the enemy. At least not at first.
No. And there's other short forms of elite panic and very weird decisions set up beforehand, including Giuliani's decision to put his put the first bunker in the sky in the only place bombed by terrorists in New York. But that's another digression.
Let me give you another Rebecca Solnit quote on topic. Quote,
eating my words, almost literally.
In the moment of disaster, the old order no longer exists, and people improvise rescues, shelters, and communities. Thereafter, a struggle takes place over whether the old order, with all its shortcomings and injustices, will be reimposed, or a new one, perhaps more oppressive or perhaps more just and free, like the disaster utopia, will arise. And that quote made me think, I wonder, is it fair to describe, let's say, the culture wars from the 60s onward, Reagan versus the counterculture, then the right wing versus Clinton, and now Obama versus the far right. Is that an extension of this tension?
You know, what I loved about disaster is that it didn't select by political affiliation, and you know, that you're all in this together. But, you know, in these long-term things, people settle back into their ruts often. Well, and some things open
settle
up.
Back into their what?
As people settle back into their ruts. And when disasters amaze me, because everything falls apart in a sense, the old order falls apart, and suddenly, you know, people are improvising a new order. And this is part of the elite panic, is that it really often a disaster unfolds a bit like a revolution in which there are no certainties, including what kind of an order you'll go back to. Can I see that question?
Yeah.
So, you know, I lost part of it in there. You know, but I think also, if you want to look at the 60s as a disaster of sorts, the Vietnam War, and this moment in which things were made into a disaster, what fascinates me about the civil rights movement in particular is that things that were the status quo suddenly became intolerable. And the incredible oppression and of segregation, discrimination, lynching, etc., which had been the status quo, people decided were... we would no longer, there was a turning point that it was not tolerable and it became a crisis, which caused really a new order to be born in some sense. So the 60s is about these moments when the status quo becomes intolerable and people rebel against it. What I, my own feeling as a person who's hopeful but not necessarily optimistic is that we've been largely winning the culture wars. And I was born into a world in which there were no laws about sexual discrimination, very few about racial discrimination. To be gay was to be considered either mentally ill or a criminal or both and be punished one way or the other. The Cold War was up, the food's, you know, and raging, and I'm the same age as the Berlin Wall and doing much better.
yes, you are.
And And I feel a lot of what the right has been doing is rearguard actions, because things that have broken open and they are changing. And a lot of the young women who aren't feminists have no idea how much feminism changed the world, and that, you know, you don't have to, you know, justify your right to reproductive freedom, or that that date rape is actually a category, or sexual harassment in the workplace is actually a category, et cetera. So, you know, so I think there's that tension. And what's really interesting about the way you frame it is that I think a lot of times the right is trying to retake the castle. They've lost it in some sense, and they feel it. And I think a lot of the paranoia and conspiracy theory, et cetera, is because if they identify with the old order, they identify with something that's disappearing in some way, and not altogether. And I think we're keeping, you know, a lot of the best things in the culture are traditional, are deeply rooted, but so are a lot of the most oppressive things, and that those have been problematized and undermined, and they've become optional, and they might be true here but aren't true there, and there are alternatives, and people everywhere, even in the most repressive communities know that there are alternatives, and you know, so that it has broken open and it hasn't gone back. It's interesting too, because the 60s is usually described as a failure, with the sense that it had this very simple program that wasn't realized. And I see it as instead being this kind of sea change that's, you know, that's not over yet, but everything is so different. And even I was reading your book a bit for preparation too, and that world seems so remote to me. And even the people rebelling against it had assumptions that would now be so considered so problematic, and things were invisible to them that are visible to us. We're in an incredibly dynamic time of change, which I think is very scary, particularly for people who see it as losing things. For a lot of the rest of us, you know, it's about gaining things, and it's often really gaining freedoms, gaining rights.
It's really interesting. I'm the father of a 40-year-old daughter, and my daughter's generation is so much more playful and fluid with feminism. I can remember when the women were beginning to struggle on the communes, when we had no idea what it was. I can remember saying to a woman who was mourning because her lover had left, and I said to her, trying to be kind, "Don't worry, some man will really like you." We had no idea, you know, who knew? And my daughter, you know, wears lipstick and high heels, and she works in prison, gives psychotherapy to prisoners, and she's just a fluid person. She just does what she wants. And I think within the left, the successive generations, like the guy who invented television, didn't know how to play with it. Our kids know how to play with computers. Yeah. But the kind of genesis of my question was, I mean, the right wing thought Bill Clinton was me. Clinton was the 60s, you know? It's like the right wing thinks Obama is a socialist. I'm a socialist. Obama is a centrist Democrat. And so I listen to this stuff and I think, like, what lens are these guys filtering this stuff through? Because I agree with you. It has a desperation that feels like loss.
You know, I think that they are, and a lot of times they're trying to restore things. They're trying to restore authoritarianism within the family. They're trying to restore essentially mandatory heterosexuality, which is, you know, one genie that's never going back in the bottle.
Is that because change is happening too quickly?
I think that for some people feel that it's at their expense, and I'm not sure that it is. And it's interesting seeing the way that, for example, with queer culture in particular, a lot of people who are convinced that somehow it was terrifying and alien, etc., when they find out that it's their cousin and the neighbor and you know, and their doctor and etc., get over it. But, you know, and I also think people are manipulated a lot, but that brings us back to, you know, discussions about corporate media and politics about this minority that is well served by agendas that don't serve the majority.
I'll share a little factoid which I just read, which is that there's no major media corporation in the United States which does not share at least one, and in most cases several, board seats with healthcare providers, either insurance companies or big HMOs or things like that. And you read this and you think, oh, well, this explains the news. This explains the perspective, why certain tangents of the argument are given such credence. But I want to talk about Rebecca Solnit. So Gary Snyder has a thesis, which he shared with me years ago, which I'm really fond of. And he calls it the Great Underground. It's a metaphor. And he describes this river, which has been a kind of parallel reality to the march of civilization as we know about it. And the Great Underground is the enduring current of priestesses, shamans, musicians, artists, craftsmen, yogins, priests, nature worshipers, people who speak for other species. And it's not like civilization wiped that out. It's like a great river that sometimes rises above ground and sometimes goes below it. And when I was reading your book, I kept thinking about, especially when I got to the section about New Orleans and how the counterculture and the church groups were merging and swapping people in their kind of selfless activity to help people. So here's the question that comes from that. I had a lot of relatives who were communists. My cousin was the first man fired from the New York City school system for being a communist. And his revenge was 28 years later, he sued him and he won all his back pay 28 years later. And so my family, the McCarthy period and the Cold War was a really big deal in my household. People were out of work, they were bankrupted. But as I get older, I think, and I keep thinking, wait a minute, communism and socialism are basically theories. They're basically ideas about the economy and ownership and stuff like that. And I don't understand quite the virulence with which they've been picked up by the population, most of which can't define socialism or communism, but they speak about it like Ann Coulter speaks about liberalism, like a kind of social toxin. And I wonder if you ever thought about that and to what you what accounts for that virulence.
You know, it's funny because I think there's a long legacy from the what got called communism in places like the Soviet Union, which was had some collective economic programs, but was essentially a totalitarian system, you know, and that wasn't sufficiently critiqued by the left soon enough and strong enough. So I think that there's a legacy from that that sees this as some kind of, you know, with some legitimacy and with a great deal of confusion and some cases intentional dishonesty as, you know, an incredibly oppressive system. And, but it's funny because these become buzzwords that don't have much to do with anything. I'm kind of, you know, and the other thing is, I live in San Francisco. I don't know how to explain the right.
But they
you know,
do
I
have
spend
agency.
Time in other places. Yeah, and I think it's funny. It's kind of like that incredible fear of taxes where people don't recognize. Although that was one of the interesting things with 9/11 is that suddenly people recognized that maybe their taxes went for legitimate things they respected. Like people were providing really valuable services. And that kind of incredible anti-government Waco Ruby Ridge kind of moment started to fade for a while there. At you know, as people saw that we are interdependent, that these people do really valuable and useful things. Some of them, the people at the bottom, and we're not talking about the people at the top. And but the fear of it, I don't quite get. And it's funny. One of my favorite political thinkers is David Graeber, the anarchist philosopher and anthropologist who kind of got drummed out of the U.S. and is now teaching at somewhere in London. And he says that basically it's all, you know, capitalism, that everything is communist and that it's all done cooperatively. And capitalism is just the worst possible way to administer communism. You know, that like if the pipe breaks and I say, hand me that wrench, you don't say, how much will you pay me for it? And, you know, that most things work that way. You know, you don't charge your kid, say to your kids, what am I bid for this bowl of porridge? Or, you know, well, you know, although there are families run a little bit too much like capitalist entities, which is a conversation we could have afterwards. But you know, and that even within Wall Street firms, they largely function by cooperation within, and there's certain, you know, and when they start to violate the rules or the rules disappear, you get the kind of catastrophe that we just had economically, you know, that the it's kind of like, you know, the red herring of free trade is the idea that we're going to have, you know, sounds like we're going to have no rules. But in fact, the rules for the WTO and NAFTA and things are these books that are like this 700 pages, 1400 pages, et cetera. And that, you know, we exist in incredibly elaborate systems of competition. I'm always amused when I'm driving that people think we're in a system of competition because you can get ahead of my car, but there's, you know, another 300 million cars on the road in the United States, and you're not going to get ahead of all of them unless you drive off the north coast of Alaska into the Bering Sea or something. And, you know, and that actually the reason we don't all kill each other is because of the cooperation around traffic rules and et cetera, or that we don't kill each other more. We do kill 50,000 a year. So I think that there's a, you know, again, that I think that we're all, that, and socialism is such a dirty or such a used up word, and communism is even worse, but I think that we're all communal and that very few people are in any way are not, and those people who are not communal are essentially tragic, the people who die alone, who are truly unconnected, the kind of Howard Hughes figures who are sort of afraid of all forms of contact and don't recognize any form of fellowship.
I call them gated communities.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, and it's been promoted a lot in the last decade, this kind of, you know, fear is good business. Trust is, you know.
You know, there's a wonderful fact that are we all right on time, Paul? Okay. There's a wonderful, another little factoid is that they have found graves from the Neolithic, 45,000 years old, 50,000 years old, in which there are corpses that were seriously maimed that survived their wounding. And they were people that were obviously incapacitated in tribal settings, that they could no longer hunt, they could no longer gather, and that they could only have survived these wounds by the cooperative care of their tribal group. And in these graves also there are many admixtures of pollens that demonstrate that they were lavished with flowers and semi-precious stones and things like that. And so really as far back as human culture goes, so does cooperation. And I'm always stunned by the fact that it's kind of overlooked, that it's part of our DNA and part of our genetics to cooperate, to want to be a herd animal, to sit and listen and talk and share things.
You know, what comes to mind is I'm couch surfing at my wonderful friend Astra Taylor, the filmmaker over there, and I looked at a book on her desk before I took off today, and it's about this fundamental instinctual cooperation. I only read the back cover, but I'm going to get the book. But it says that, you know, if you drop something, the two-year-old will pick it up and hand it to you, that cooperation is kind of hardwired in. And stuff. And this is what Kropotkin's Mutual Aid is about the fact that that human beings, like most other species, survived more through cooperation than competition, that most human beings for most of history lived in extended kinship networks rather than the war of each against each, and that it's actually very modern to be in this kind of isolation. But I think some of us, you know, I have a piece of my kinship network in the front row, but they apparently don't want to be identified. They'll blush.
Are they sending you subterranean signals?
I think this is something we don't name that much. These systems, these quite wonderful systems that are part of most people's lives and that do take care of people in individual and collective crises. And again, you know, we say we're in a capitalist system and that capitalism is based on competition, etc. But most of us are alive because of enormous networks of cooperation. Or we would have died hideously some time back.
Right, which are largely invisible to the majority culture.
We don't identify and celebrate and name them that much. And they do more in some societies. Or they think that we celebrate them, but we don't name them. And so we know they're there, but we don't necessarily have the language to acknowledge them, to take care of them, to see what strengthens them, to discuss what weakens them, to make decisions.
Is this our task as writers, to name them and give shape and form to them?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's probably the only one-word answer I'll give, and I've just ruined it.
Well, you made another distinction, which you touched on lightly earlier, but I really like it. I'm always struck by the way that in Buddhist practice, you know, we put a lot of emphasis on intention.
Yeah.
And there's this feeling that if your intention is compassionate and generous, even if you're not very bright, things will kind of work out. And if your intention is selfish, you can't be smart enough to prevent things from working out badly. And so the intention of communism and socialism is very, very different, let's say, than the intention of fascism. Maybe both have failed equally horrifically, but the intentions are different and attracted different people. And there's this line I took from your book that I really appreciated, where you said, many fail to notice that it's not the ideals, the ends, but the coercive and authoritarian means that poison paradise.
Yeah, a lot of you know there's this whole truism that, attempts to build utopia always turn into gulags and totalitarianism, which is one of the kind of cheap, cynical truisms of our age. And David Graeber actually dismantles it elegantly, and I quote him in there. Everybody should read David Graeber, too. But he really, you know, it's really not, utopian ideals don't do that at all. It's the authoritarian means, which is, I have such a clear vision of utopia, I know exactly what will work, and I need to execute all the enemies of paradise. And, you know, and which creates, and Milan Kundera, who's lived in one of those things, writes about it in the Book of Laughter and Forgetting, that you create a bigger and bigger gulag of all the people who don't fit into your paradise that never quite gets off the ground. But that's not really about high ideals, that's about the willingness to use hideous means. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Subcomandante Marcos, who's one of my major influences, says the means are the end. And I think that one of the great changes of revolution in our times is the sense that the means themselves have to be, you know, that you have to live by your principles all the way, that you can't build a peaceful community with by executing people, that you can't...
Lead by listening.
Yeah, yeah.
So this leads me to another question, because it just turns out that I was in Mexico in January when GATT and NAFTA passed and the Zapatista revolution began. It did not skip my notice, as you might guess. And one of the things that that sort of leads me back to this loop when I've been pondering the ambivalence of the virtual and the cybernetic community and how it relates to the fact, you know, a kind of political chaos where progressive people and those forces of paradise are not achieving dominance. I look around the world and I see the poorest, barefootest, most deprived citizens in the world rising up and throwing the bastards out. I see Bolivian Indians throwing out French multinationals. I see the Zapatistas throwing out the governor. And I'm wondering, what is it? Is it that we have too much to lose, or is it that we haven't been pressed to the wall enough to finally say, you know something, I'm tired of living this way. This is how I want to live. I want to live cooperatively and in a celebratory manner, and I'm just tired of this stuff. And I keep, you know, I'm getting old and long in the tooth, but I keep waiting. I wouldn't call for violence or revolution, but a kind of obdurateness on the part of people who believe, as you and I do, to say, enough's enough. And I wonder why it doesn't happen here, but it does happen among people who have nothing.
You know what? One of the things that, this is a tangential answer because I'm not sure I have a direct one, is I wrote a book about hope when the war broke out, because I'm a contrarian, for one thing, and because people needed it, for another. And I went around talking about hope, and I would often find these kind of affluent, middle-aged, left-wing people would get very, very angry at me. I now jokingly refer to that book as Snatching the Teddy Bear of Despair from the Loving Arms of the Left. And, you know, and what was really interesting is that they would suggest that being hopeful was insensitive to the plight of oppressed peoples. And I'd be like, well, the oppressed peoples are really hopeful. The Zapatistas are all about Esperanza. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers, who are these undocumented farm workers in Florida who've done the fantastic organizing, and they've beat Jack in the Box and they've beat McDonald's in their struggles, are incredibly hopeful. And I realized that for some people, the alternative to these wild hopes is dying hideous deaths of violence, of starvation, of marginalization. The alternative for comfortable people to hope is comfortable cynicism and more shopping and television. And, you know, and it was really interesting. And hope demands a lot of you. Despair demands, and cynicism demand very little. I think it really is, you know, that the Zapatistas and people, you know, the people of Bolivia, et cetera, came very close to being rubbed out and, you know, pushed back with vigor, but also with profound inspiration, with mm-hmm. poetic language, with incredible and contagious vision. And, you know, and they are an influence. We do have amazing movements in this country that are very connected to those things. You know, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers is here and has a lot of native-born Americans working with them. There's a lot of that going on, but... you know, getting at that comfortable cynicism has been one of the things, seems to be one of my jobs.
Yeah, you write about that beautifully. And, you know, I'm never one of those people that would try to pour a quart into a pint pitcher. I don't think that we'll ever make a world without greed, hate, and delusion,
yeah,
and all these negative aspects. But if you can have a dark age, you can have a golden age.
Yeah.
When I look at Chichen Itza, or I look at Teotihuacan, or look at Angkor Wat, you don't get the vision that these fantastic pyramids were built by oppressed slaves. There's just too much beauty in every little nook and cranny, and so I am hopeful. I remain hopeful, but I still wonder as I watch revolution after revolution and people taking control of their own destiny. I'm curious about the United States and the one that my granddaughter will inherit.
Well, we did it too. If you look at the neoliberal vision in
1990,
neoliberal vision for the world in 1999, before the Seattle WTO, really they thought, you know, most people, including a lot of people who were opposed to it, thought that these free trade agreements were some kind of juggernaut that nothing could stop. There were bulldozers that would run over everything in their way, you know, and the mice went out and stopped the elephant. And, you know, there was this kind of plan in 1999 that was like this, and we've just diverged further and further and further from it as, you know, all of Latin America in the last decade, almost all of Latin America, and Colombia and a few other places are exceptions, has swung far not only to the left, which is a political position, but to more democratic, populist, engaged, and often indigenous power. Remarkable things have happened. And that was partly because George Bush was too busy messing up the Middle East. But also within the United States, there's been enormous movements to push back around media control, around food politics, around a lot of things like that. And I think that the week the war broke out, somebody told me there are 7,000 groups devoted to protecting rivers in the United States, which is, and 7,000 is a lot, which is not really the sign of a passive or disengaged populace. And, you know, I think enormous things are being done. And often what we're doing is counterbalancing that, you know, we're counterbalancing damage. And when I wrote about hope, one of the things that stuck with me, and I had to sort of figure out, I had to make the, I always the lawyer, you know, for the defense for hope. It was an interesting position. Just as this book, I feel like a death penalty exoneration lawyer for the entire species, in some sense, at fighting the Hobbesian. But a lot of times what our victories look like is nothing. And there's so many places, so many people haven't been executed, so many forests that haven't been clear cut, so many rivers that haven't been dammed, so many species that haven't gone extinct, so many people who haven't died alone in misery because of all these actions. And they're often very invisible. Often they achieve these things in small ways. Often it's not very recognizable. Very few people go to a lot of these places and say, wow, I don't see a dam here. Wow, all these trees could
be
timber.
That's a really good point.
You know, so I think that a lot of what in the United States is the pesticides that were banned, you know, because of people like Rachel Carson, which is the birds that didn't go extinct. And you actually live on the north side of the Golden Gate Bridge. I can disclose that much information, I hope. And one of the things, I had this amazing walk with one of the people at the Point Reyes Bird Observatory that was part of how I got hopeful in the Bush era. And he started naming, I grew up in that county, all these species that came back. Elephant seals almost went extinct. They were down to a few hundred in 1900, and we stopped hunting them. In a weird way, we stopped hunting them in whales because of petroleum, so we got some other problems. But whales and elephant seals rebounded. Because of the lack of pesticides, brown pelicans rebounded, and peregrine falcons, and white-tailed kites. And there are coyotes in San Francisco now. There were basically almost no coyotes when I was growing up in Marin.
All over my
and stuff.
Ridge.
And so there's these weird, you know, you know, there's weird ways in which things have gotten better and richer and more interesting. And, you know, between 1990 and 2000, the number of Native Americans on the census doubled, not because every Native person had at least one child, but because twice as many people wanted to identify as Native American than did, because the cultural politics changed so radically. And the stuff around the quincentennial that happened to reassert that Native people were here, they weren't going away, they weren't just the past, they were the future, which is Zapatista uprising, and the Bolivian stuff also comes out of, was one of those incredible moments in which culture becomes the fertile soil new flowers grow out of. And that was the change I saw that really made me hopeful. And I was participated in some way in the 90s. But I saw that national parks and children's textbooks and signage and mainstream television and cowboy movies and everything else completely reimagined the categories of nature, mm-hmm. history, and the Americas because of this insurgent imagination coming from marginalized scholars and people who'd been hitherto pretty much invisible and told that they were part of the past or that told that they had already disappeared.
Did you read Paul Hawkins' newest book?
I did.
Tell me the name because I'm having a senior moment.
I'm having a middle-aged moment. Blessed Unrest.
Yeah, Blessed Unrest. There's a wonderful metaphor in Paul Hawkins' newest book where he does a survey of the million social justice and environmental organizations on the face of the planet. All over the planet, you know, Save Poudre Creek, Free the So-and-So Six. If you add them all up, it becomes the biggest social movement in the history of the planet. And he likens it to the human immune system. Diffuse, non-centralized, but as a kind of life-affirming response to global depredations. And that was a metaphor that gave me a lot of hope that I liked a great deal.
And to go back to Paradise Built in Hell, in some sense you could see this as an immune system that reacts to a disaster by flaring up, mm-hmm. but it's always present in some sense. And that's one of the sense that I came out of this project with, is that you, in disaster, you have these extraordinary moments where altruism and solidarity and stuff step forward, but it's there in some way. My friend Marina Citrin, who's a New Yorker, pointed out to me she's never seen a woman wait for more than 30 seconds to get help taking a baby carriage up the subway steps. That there is mutual aid in everyday life in a place that's supposed to be all tough and hard ass.
So I want to ask you a question before Paul flags us.
Okay.
There was something that really surprised me and showed me one of my own prejudices. As I said, I come from a real left-wing family, and we tend to think of very often governmental responses to things. And you were talking about Morin and Dorothy Day.
Yeah.
And the Catholic Daily Worker and radical, engaged Catholic political work. And you said Morin and Day were not enthusiasts for the New Deal that arose from the radical politics and radical needs of Depression America. They believed that, quote, the works of mercy could be practiced to combat the taking over by the state of all those services which could be built up by mutual aid. And it struck me as just like a vision of great beauty. And somehow I realized, yes, the counterculture was something like that. But since then, most of my energy has been concentrating in my thinking anyway about like government taking over its obligations and services to community. And it made me think of Vaclav Havel's wonderful quote. I can paraphrase it, where he described that there's nothing preventing a shopkeeper from sweeping the sidewalk in front of his store, and nothing preventing a salesperson from being kind and generous, and that there are all of these services that we do not require government to do. And I really was greatly appreciative of that, of you stopping me in my tracks and going, yeah, that's here.
And Vaclav Havel was part of the Velvet Revolution that was so much part of recognizing the powers people already had, and even under a totalitarian regime, and building on them until, you know, the grass got so strong it cracked the sidewalk. And
did you see Rock and Roll, Tom Stoppard's play?
I didn't.
Well, if you should read it.
Okay.
And because it was about exactly that, about a little rock and roll band that no one ever heard in Czechoslovakia that became the germ of a countercultural revolution that overthrew the state, the Plastic Fantastic People. It's a great play. Do you want to open this to questions?
Yeah.
She wants to close the conversation.
I don't want to close the conversation, but I don't feel like including everyone here will be closing it.
This conversation cannot be closed.
It can. Two mics, and we would ask you to raise your hand, get up, and ask a question rather than make an elaborate comment.
Yes.
Are they going for the microphone or fleeing for the door? Yes, you have to stand up.
No, you don't. But you have to speak.
Yeah, I hesitate. such a huge question. But you're talking about capitalism and communism and socialism. I remember when I asked my father when I was a child about capitalism, when I started to resent it and reject it as a system, and he said, but no one will be motivated to do anything if we don't have, you know, if we have a system where everybody is not, you know, paid unequally because they think they're working harder and therefore getting rewarded more. And I've never gotten over that. Now I have an 11-year-old who's asking me similar questions. And what system, my question is, what system then do you envision that would be, obviously, you know,
ooh, that is big.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's okay. That's okay.
It's on my mind.
Well, you know, the species evolved without capitalism, which is a new, weird, aberrant form of doing things for the last few centuries. And I like David Graeber saying that, you know, we remain communards or a communal species, and capitalism is just the worst possible way of administering communal things. You know, I think the notion that inequality drives people, I'm not sure that's true, since lots of people in this culture, you know, not every, you know, it certainly doesn't seem to be producing, you know, because they're always talking about capitalism as though it's this experiment that will produce these results, except that the experiment wasn't pure, but it really would work if we just let it do this and stuff. And, you know, capitalism produces, or this, you know, the economic system, which isn't pure capitalism either, but it produces a lot of poverty and alienation and disaffection and alcoholism and loneliness and really bad TV. And, you know, and I think that there are alternatives, and I think, you know, they involve a lot more local and grassroots and horizontal control over individual lives and collective systems. I'm reading Bill McKibben's new book, which has something in common with his book Deep Economy, which is about the idea that in order to create a world in which we pull back on creating climate change, we need to create essentially local systems of survival. And it's an interesting thing because people tend to think that our response to climate change, which is different than or maybe isn't different than capitalism, but that's, you know, we need to engage in some kind of hideous sacrifice and misery and self-denial. And Bill's actually saying, actually, we have hideous sacrifice and self, you know, and privation and denial in the system we have. And what we'll actually get is a much richer system in which people will be more deeply connected to each other, to their food production, to their local culture, to their weather and their seasons and their nature and their water, etc. You know, and I think that, you know, I don't believe in, you know, some kind of massive state regulation of all economy as an alternative. I'm basically an anarchist anyway. But I believe in decentralization and that things actually, you know, there are lots of examples of things that work quite well without hierarchies of, you know, divisions of labor, but without hierarchies with collective decision making. There are lots of examples of things that have worked very, very differently than capitalism, in which people actually have a very good time and produce the circumstances of their survival and do more than survive. They thrive and even enjoy. And, you know, and a lot of the counterculture was really, and the counterculture that showed up in Katrina was about those things. And I became a fan, I'm kind of anti-hippie. I don't know if I told you that yet, but because I was
we didn't call ourselves hippies.
They called you that because I was a punk rocker. But I gained enormous respect for the Rainbow family, which put on the annual Rainbow Festival, which is about 30,000 to 40,000 people improvising a system of survival in a national forest, completely through consensus. There are no paid roles, unlike Burning Man, which just hires medics and porta potties. They take care of the sanitation. They take medics and nurses and doctors. Yeah, Burning Man is a limited liability corporation, which is not too utopian. The Rainbow Gathering is actually run, you know, they essentially build a short-term city entirely through anarchist consensus means. And that training gave them the resources to show up in Katrina and put out community kitchens immediately that actually were running until late 2008 in some cases, and also to set up long-term disaster relief organizations that still exist that are going to other disasters around the country. You know, there are alternatives and they do work. And it's funny because I think that we also, you know, it's also important to acknowledge that our system doesn't work very well. We have more material abundance than any nation ever imagined in the history of the world before World War II. And we have so many malnourished and hungry people in this country. We have so many homeless people. I should probably end this wild digression with my favorite Sitting Bull anecdote. Sitting Bull, after his defeat, joined Buffalo Bill's Wild West Circus, but never really ended up saving anything from his salary because he gave it all to the street urchins. He was shocked to see all these hungry kids in this incredibly affluent and powerful society that had defeated him. And he said, the white man is good at production, but he's not good at distribution.
I doubt, I'm just taking a wild guess, but I'm going to guess that you were not motivated to have a child by bringing another earning unit into the family, that something arose within you. And I think within all of us, the mind itself has a ceaseless creative play and will permeate and permutate all the things that were given around us. Left to its own devices, it will do it in very joyous and beautiful manners. And if you look at pre-civilized people, everything they made beautifully, because there was a relationship between the integrity of manufacture of a basket or an arrow or a spear or a snare or a woven rope and its utility. And so to me, the great snake oil act that we've all bought is that this story about motivation, that actually, if you didn't have to work, you would become an irrepressible font of wonderful things to do for your family and your kids. And I was lucky enough to live 10 years, some of my friends are still here, where every night we played music, we played board games, we talked, we thought, we did cooperative work. And one of the things that I learned from this life, this communal life, and I'll be quite frank about it, could I have gotten free health care and free quality education for my children? I'd still be living on a commune because I think it's an incredibly rich broth to live in. But one of the things that we learned was that for any given task, there was a natural leader for that task. And as long as everybody said, oh yeah, Vinny knows what he's doing, and you just followed Vinny for that task. And then as soon as the task was over, just like a wave falling back into the body of the ocean, that person's authority would diminish. So you can look at this thing that we're calling capitalism as a problem of solidifying status and authority. Yeah, there may be people that really know how to build a highway or do an operation, and in the appropriate task, they should rise and they should be leaders and we should listen to them. It's when the task is over, we may not need them shaping the country or doing the entire thing. So I think your dad was passing on received wisdom that he hadn't actually tested, and that if he didn't have to go to work, he would have probably found some wondrous hobby that would have actually been the basis of a livelihood that he might have found deeply joyous and supportive.
I think people like to work. They just don't like most of the work that's available to them. And I'm lucky. I love my work and do it a lot. But I haven't had a boss or an office since 1988. And, and it's funny to go back to your dad. I could... Oh, yeah, no, but okay, so tell your dad. You know, and it's funny because occasionally I get grumpy. You know, I paid a lot of dues before I became middle class, living on my writing and stuff. And I would just always remind myself, if I had wanted to be a corporate lawyer, I could have been a corporate lawyer. You know, I could have made one of those huge salaries. And most people make their life decisions based on other things. And, you know, doctors are really well paid, but people, you know, but even they, and the initiation rites and the difficulty, the emotional demands of what they do, people have a lot of other reasons for why they do what they do, a lot of them. But, you know, we should have more questions. We should have a question from you, for example. And you should have a microphone, which you may use sitting up or standing down.
How about kneeling?
That's entirely up to you.
Which I might. Because this is a question about tension. And when you say sitting down and standing up, it's an example of tension. And you talked about capitalism or cooperation, and I have to position myself. I'm feeling like I need to position myself.
Okay.
I'm 1 month and 1 week old in New York. Mm-hmm. I moved from Houston, where I've been working with people who moved from New Orleans, since 2005. I'm a disaster mental health specialist, and I moved here to work at the International Trauma Studies, where a colleague of mine has been working around 9/11. So I may get emotional about speaking to this issue. I want to thank you for this book, because in the field, as we talk about it, it's still a very individualistic model and not a communal model. I'm here trying to recoup from having to do this kind of work, where trying to talk to people about not getting hung up in these labels or groups, but being in relationships and being in groups with each other. So I'm literally sitting here and saying, I'm going to go back tonight and email hundreds of people like, this book, read this. This is what we've been talking about. So thank you for that.
Thank you. I would love to meet with some of them and talk to, and learn what things look like from their perspective. And yeah. So the question.
So the question is, and this is a question that's personal and professional, because it's a question of tension. I feel I moved, and I come from a country, India, where to be social, to be cooperative is what I was raised with. And I've struggled in Houston around that. And I've come to New York in search of public space. But the tension I see is walking into stores, and when you're going to check out, no one looks at you. They don't say hi, they don't say hello. So there's this tension of it being public and yet private. There's this tension that I'm asking, are you talking to the holding of the two tensions of capitalism and socialism, or are you saying, recognize and let's grow it? And I ask that because as a psychotherapist, I say what we focus on grows. And that's why I appreciate your book, because I think we need to grow the message that you're putting out there. And I haven't read the book, but based on this. But are we saying we need to let go of the other or keep the tension?
You know, well, I don't think I get to make the decision for the rest of the nation, but I'd be all for letting go of capitalism, since you asked. So what really struck me, though, and I'd be curious what your experience was, with Katrina, the terrible sense of loss of a lot of those displaced people, whether they're displaced because they came back to New Orleans and their community was gone, or because they ended up in Denver or Salt Lake City or Houston or something like that, was that they lost something most people in the United States hadn't had in generations. And it was very strange for me to see that they had lost a sense of deep individual and collective historic roots. And, you know, I think of it as being like a tree. They had deep roots in the past, whether it was where that their great-grandfather lived in the same house, or that they knew exactly where this music came from 150 years ago that they were playing. And these broad branches of knowing everybody in the neighborhood, of having hundreds of cousins and aunts and things around. And, you know, and that's what was severed by Katrina. And so they really lost more than most of us have in this country in some ways. And it was interesting because I had thought that I was going to find some kind of deeply indigenous community where a disaster was only a disaster because there was nothing to gain because they already had this kind of carnival spirit of community and public life and stuff. And a new one still has it in some way, and new communities are being built and divides across communities. You know, and it's not that New Orleans was paradise. It was also in a very segregated and racist place. You know, and but so these aren't answers. These are sort of the questions I come away from this with. But it's also interesting that you're responding this way, because I've been worried, because there is the trauma model that human beings are very weak and fragile, and that their only response to something terrible is trauma, and that there's often what gets called traumatic growth, that people become stronger, that they discover resources in themselves, which are a lot of the stories that I told and that I've heard from people in Katrina. So I don't know, and I think, essentially, somebody who's lived in one city for almost 30 years, you build villages within the city, and that the longer you're here, the more you build them. I walked to a radio interview a couple weeks ago, and it's something I may write about for a project I'm on now, where, you know, I didn't run into anybody I knew on the street, although I do regularly, and I have bookstores and other places where I know the proprietors and the staff and things. But I was just walking past, there was a Harvey Milk Memorial Center that a friend of mine was the public artist for. There's a place where my friend Kat, performed a dance. There was the bar that my friend Guillermo likes to hang out and stuff. And so the landscape was peopled by this network but it takes a long time to build up. And it's funny because New Yorkers will be much less afraid of human contact, but it sounds like you're saying they're not all that warm and fuzzy. And the last thing that I think of is get warm and fuzzy, people. But the last thing I think of is that Pat Enkyu O'Hara, who is this amazing, she's the abbess of the Village Zendo here, told me that for a few weeks after 9/11, it was like everybody had become a Buddhist. They looked you right in the face on the subway. They made eye contact. They wanted to know how you were. They weren't in a hurry. And then it was this beautiful, wonderful thing that she watched kind of slip away, but that she saw it with everyone, just about everyone here. So, and so it's interesting to me how we, get the fruit of disaster without getting the disaster. And it seems to be a lot like how you get to Carnegie Hall, practice, 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 which has a specifically Buddhist meaning.
Well, I just had one tiny little insight. When the trade relations were being made between Japan and the United States, and Japan set up a number of department stores in the United States and Canada. And, of course, they brought their own staff, and they repatriated all the money to Japan. But they trained the staff, and one of the very first things you notice is that you cannot walk into a Japanese store without being saluted. Someone says, hello, can I help you? And they step forward. And it's a cultural thing. And one of the reasons that Japanese products are so good is because the Japanese consumer is the most discriminating consumer on the planet. They just won't put up with stuff that we will put up with. So I think one of the ways to deal with the tension, my son and I had this today. We went to a place for lunch and I got there and he was put out because they had treated him rudely when we came in. And I said, let's go. And I don't stay in a store. If I'm in a store for 30 seconds and no one has said hello to me or can I help you, I just leave. And I think that those are powers that we have. Or you can be generous and go up and say, could you help me, please? And based on their response, you can decide to stay and shop. And I think that's the level that which Vaclav Havel was talking about, where we can face the tension directly. Yes, you've had a bad day as a sales girl and you have problems I don't know anything about, but you have a job which is to greet me. And if I was a doctor and I didn't do my job well because I was having a bad day, it would be intolerable and insufferable. And I don't see why we should give one another a pass to be unkind, to be thoughtless, and to be rude. There are ways of confronting it directly that are not hostile and aggressive. And if you can't crack through on a human dimension, you can take your business someplace else.
Let's take one last question.
Thank you. I want to thank you for giving us this interesting conversation. And I'm from China, and I've been a New Yorker for 3 weeks, so a bit younger than you.
Welcome.
Thank you. And I'm just wondering, we're talking about capitalism and communism and socialism. I can't resist myself from asking this question. Would you take the example of China as a success of sort of the mingle of communism and capitalism?
God, no.
I don't know. Or that there are, I don't know, there are good things. I mean, as a Chinese citizen who have lived in the foreign society, in the Western context for 3 years, I've learned about both sides of arguments a bit, but from what I have seen in, such as last year in the earthquake, millions of volunteers disaster zone, and the Communist Party was trying to help. They did good things and they did bad things. And I want to refer back to one of the points this lady said. If there is no capitalism, if there is only the communal sense, how will we be motivated to work? But if we I don't know, combine the both. China has been doing really badly on a lot of things, like human rights, everything. But economically, it has been growing. So I don't know, I'm really confused, and I would be interested to hear your answer. Thank you.
You know, I don't know enough about China to give a really informed answer, but I think that there are, you know what, when we're talking about capitalism here, we've been sort of slinging the word around very loosely. I would be talking about corporate capitalism, which empowers, you know, corporate entities with human rights and superhuman powers. And a corporation has all the rights to sue for libel and use the First Amendment to defend itself, et cetera, that you and I do, except that it is worth billions of dollars and may live for hundreds of years, et cetera. So we've created these kind of, these gods of sorts that serve their own interest and not ours. And so it's really about creating accountable systems that are accountable, which is often about making them more small scale. About Jan Sandra Sotomayor did this amazing thing where she questioned the basis for corporate personhood, which was really a legal decision of Southern Pacific versus Southern Pacific Railroad, one of the first monster corporations in the United States, versus the County of Santa Clara in the 1880s. And, you know, so I think there's enormous ways to reinvent these things. You know, we have these two poles of kind of corporate capitalism and sort of totalitarian state control of everything, as, you know, and it's kind of like, would you like to burn to death or would you like to freeze to death? And, you know, I think that there's lots of ways of doing lots of things, and it's not a one, you know, that are not ones I can't prescribe because it's not one size fits all, but that are neither. And, you know, so, and I bet Peter is not short on opinions either about this.
You know, at the root of it, there are Chinese human beings and there are American human beings. And there are dense, centralized systems controlling both and exerting pressures on both. There's graft in both. There's corruption in both. There are people doing things for wealth that turn around and imperil those people. So when I look at China, I see millions of people coming to aid in a disaster that was also caused by graft and bribery and building. So I don't think we have to choose one or the other. I think what we have to say is, in this local situation, amongst these people that we know, what's the best way of operating? You know, I mean, when I served for 8 years in state government in California, and one of the things that we did was we created a map of the state that was based on bioregions. And a bioregion is a plant, animal, climate, human community where people within it seem to live sort of the same way. Like Southern California is high Sonoran desert. It's all the way down into northern Mexico the same way. San Francisco is a bioregion that extends all the way up into Washington State. We have cedar trees and ravens and salmon and fog and winter rains. And the people there have organized themselves to live in a way that makes sense. It has nothing to do with state lines on a map or dictates from Washington. So I think that it's sort of a false question. The real question is, here we are as a species in a specific place with a specific set of needs. How do we take care of each other? How do we get to do what we want? And how do we minimize the most destructive aspects of our nature and maximize the most cooperative? And I think people who would force you to choose are really trying to stop the discussion of what can I do right here and right now with you. I'm listening to you speak beautiful English. I can't speak three words of Chinese. And when I think of trying to go to China to open an American restaurant, I'm paralyzed with fear. And yet there's something about that culture that creates an autonomy and independence that brings millions of people here to do that very successfully. So we have a lot to learn from China. And I think Western European Enlightenment tradition has a great deal to share. And we don't have to buy one system or the other. We can be cherry pickers.
Thank you very, very much.